My perspective is that we should not be knowingly interfering with our endocrine system with any of our day-to-day practices, and that it is healthful and ideal to encourage our endocrine systems to work as well as possible rather than knowingly inhibit them, which all methods of chemical contraception inhibit endocrine function, including plants. So that's why I recommend them only in the case of an oops rather than a regular method.
You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily Giles.
Hi, I'm Emily, and this is the Untaming Podcast. Today it is the new hunger moon here in the Southern Hemisphere. My last episode with Katie Singer has really stuck with me. It makes me feel like a huge hypocrite for sharing this content online and contributing to the utter ecological devastation caused by technology. I think the way I try to reconcile this despair is to only use the technologies I actually need and not to purchase unnecessary things in the first place. Obviously, that will look very different for different households with different capabilities in different areas of the world. But in my own family's everyday life, things like dishwashers, microwaves, most kitchen appliances really, TVs, couches, chairs, most lights, lawnmowers, carpets, extractor fans, most toys, even beds, or at least bed bases, are all unnecessary to us. You know, as a society, we've been marketed these things over the years for their ease of use to make our lives more comfortable, so that a lot of people in Western society believe they're necessary and can't fathom how we ever function without them. And that ease of use and slightly improved comfort is actually weakening us physically, making us lazier, making us reliant on these things so that we truly believe we require them because we've become unable to carry out regular tasks without them. And that's not even acknowledging the resources and extensive supply chains and ecological devastation that has gone into their entire manufacturing. As this episode is, it will be 2 weeks before we move onto our new land. And something that has been prevalent in my mind leading up to this move is that I intend to start our lives there the way I hope to continue. So every item that comes into a house, I think, is this necessary? Is this physically weakening our bodies? Is this making us dependent on this item so that we do not know how to function without it? And finally, is it a waste of money, time, space, and resources in every extent of the word? You know, I truly believe that the internet will crash at some point, like permanently crash, simply because it is not sustainable. We know that from my conversation with Katie. Whether that's going to crash in 1 year or in 30 years, who knows? But that is one of the reasons I have a large collection of books and why I try to live in a way that myself and my children acknowledge the internet as a temporary luxury item, not something that's essential to life. Obviously, this is just my perspective of what I can do in my own life. I'd love to know your thoughts on these things, so feel free to email me or just comment on one of the Untaming posts on Instagram or Facebook if you'd like to initiate a dialogue on this. Anyway, sorry, that was a bit of a rant from me. In the next episode, I chat with Ainsley Rowan again. You may remember her from last year. She is a chiropractor and has a lot to share regarding movement for parents and children. But today we are talking about fertility awareness with Samantha Zipora. Enjoy. Year-old Samantha Zipora was born in and grew up in Idaho, has lived in many places, and currently lives in Colorado with her partner and her cat. Samantha is a fertility, sex, and cycle educator, author, and activist with over 20 years of experience in personal, professional, and clinical contexts. For over a decade, she served pregnant people and their families as a professional doula for birth, miscarriage, and abortion. She provided care for pregnancy experiences and other gynecological processes and procedures professionally in hospitals, clinics, and home settings. Her friends have joked that her business tagline should be, "If anything's going in or out of a cervix, call Sam." Last night, she had 8 or 9 hours of sleep, and for lunch today, she had a ginger carrot soup with kale in it and sourdough seed toast with avocado. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I first heard of you a couple of years ago when a listener recommended you as a guest for this podcast. And after following you for all that time, we're finally doing this interview. Now, there's a lot of ground I'd love to cover today. So let's start with the big one. What can you teach us about tracking our natural fertility?
What can I teach you? I can teach you the three primary fertility signals are biomarkers of when we are actually fertile. The first one being our fluids that come out from little tiny glands inside of the cervix. Only when we are fertile, usually around 3 to 6 days prior to the moment of ovulation, we start releasing fertile fluids that are, you know, everybody's bodies are slightly different, but generally fertile fluids are pretty gooey, kind of like egg whites. And then the second primary fertility signal is the temperature. So one would need to take their temperature at the same time every morning. There are some devices out there that will take your temperature continuously throughout the evening while you're sleeping and, you know, give you an average of those. That works pretty well, but the ideal way to do it is to take the temperature before you get out of bed while you're still lying down, just orally. Some people think that, oh no, it's fertility, might need to take my temperature vaginally, but that is not the case. And then after we ovulate, our temperature spikes because of a hormone called progesterone, which I always describe progesterone as the pro-gestation hormone. It's essentially, it has many functions, but one of them is actually raising the body's temperature, essentially to put a bun in the oven is a phrase that we use here in the States. I don't know if that's something that y'all where you are to describe a pregnancy. So it's like preheating the oven just in case you want to put a bun in the oven, this hormone progesterone, and causes a temperature spike. So the third primary fertility signal is the cervical texture and position. And actually, when we are in the fertile window, the fertile phase, the primary signal again is the fluids, and the presence of the fluids opens the fertile window or the fertile wave. But during that fertile wave, the cervix is actually softer and higher in the vagina. And when we are not fertile, it is harder and lower down. So those are the three primary fertility signals that one would track if you were going to practice what is called the symptothermal method of fertility awareness. But there are many, many different types of fertility awareness practices out there. Some of them are fluids only. And then, of course, in this modern world, there are many different types of at-home hormone testing, just as you could, you know, urinate on a stick to test if you're pregnant. You can also pee on strips to test various different hormones that surge at different moments in the cycle to be able to identify where you are in your cycle and whether or not you are fertile.
Right. Now, is this still relevant for somebody who, say, has an irregular cycle?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And what could be done for someone to help regulate a cycle, like diet, exercise, stress, sleep, that sort of thing?
Yes, all of those things that you just mentioned.
Oh, right. Okay, great.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of nuance. Having I always joke that I'm going to someday write a book that's just called The Sleeping and Pooping Guide to Fertility. As there are many, many different factors that influence our overall wellness, our hormones and our cycles, but proper sleep and proper digestion which we can measure via our bowel movements, are two of the main things I would suggest really tuning into to be able to regulate hormones and thus the cycle.
Oh, I just want to go back to that, what you said about bowel movements. What then would you look for in your bowel movements?
You would look for the texture and the regularity of them to make sure that they are happening in a healthy way, as it is one of the primary ways that we detox from all of the endocrine disruptors, all of the synthetic hormones that are in our modern day environment that are pretty unavoidable. Digestion and bowel movements are one of the main ways we clear those. So knowing what is the ideal texture and timing of those movements is one really good way to judge whether or not your hormones are clearing from your body in a healthful way.
Now, you mentioning like all the synthetic hormones and things that are in the environment, endocrine disruptors that are influencing our hormones. I'm thinking of somebody who's been on synthetic contraceptives, and if they are coming off them, how long would it take to see these fertility changes in their own bodies? Would it take like just one cycle or a few months?
Yeah, everybody's body is unique, so there's no way to make a blanket general statement that is going to be an absolute truth. From what I understand in terms of the data we have available, it's around 6 months to experience healthy, normal ovulation. On average, it's around 6 months until, and we define healthy cycle and healthy ovulation by measuring the levels of progesterone, that progestation hormone that I mentioned earlier, that should surge after a healthy ovulation. There are, of course, other hormones and markers for a healthy cycle, but that progesterone surge is really fundamental.
Right. And what would be, what would identify to be like, oh yes, I can see in myself, in my body, that I have reached this regular cycle now. I've reached a healthy cycle. Like you've said those three things you mentioned before about the fluids and the cervix and the temperature. Are there other things you would see, I don't know, in the length of your cycle or, I don't know, something else?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much information. It's kind of hard for me to land sometimes.
Yeah.
Where to begin. I would refer back to that temperature spike as one of the best ways you can tell, again, if you are experiencing adequate levels of progesterone without needing to invest in the test strips. You'll want to see a healthy temperature spike that sustains itself for at least a few days post-ovulation. Again, that raised temperature is directly caused by the level of progesterone that is in the body. And so, yeah, we're getting right into the, you know, all of the viscera and the gooey and the texture and the body functions here, talking about, you know, cervical fluids and bowel movements and now blood, right? The consistency of your menstrual blood, the color of your menstrual blood, the length of the time that you are bleeding. Those are also ways that we tell if you're having a healthy cycle. Between 21 and 35 days, it's pretty broad range. That idea that every healthy menstrual cycle is 28 days long is not true. You can have a healthy cycle and have it be anywhere between 21 and 35 days. But the main thing you're looking for really is regularity, whether you tend to be a 30-day cycle or a 25-day cycle, how consistent are the lengths of your cycle, and is your blood a healthy, vibrant color and texture? How long are you bleeding? Are you cramping? There are many, many different factors here.
No, I really appreciate you clarifying that that length can be so broad, because every time you look up anything in a book or online, it always just refers to that 28-day average.
Yeah. And so I have a self-study course that is called the Conscious Contraception Skillshare, and it's available by donation. I just made all of my self-study courses available by donation in light of what is happening politically here in the United States with the persecution of fertility management. And so my course is not just about contraception, but it's also about cycle healing. And the first half of the whole course is about how to heal and observe your cycle in a healthy way. And then once you're having a healthy cycle that you understand how to observe and interpret, then interpreting it for the purpose of contraception.
Right. Now, when in the cycle would you want to have sex if you're trying to have a baby?
Well, it depends on what you mean by sex. I feel like it's really important that we stop defining sex as a penis and a vagina until it ejaculates, and really embrace the variety of activities that can bring orgasms and pleasure and intimacy. I believe that sex and sexuality are much more expansive than that act. But I can assume that what you mean is, at what point do you want to put sperm in your vagina to conceive? Yes. Is that yeah. the question you're asking me?
That is, yeah, thanks.
So that would be during the fertile window or the fertile wave, where we have those fertile fluids I was talking about earlier, which are the primary fertility signal. They have the same pH as sperm, roughly, and they also have like snacks and sugar for the sperm to stay alive. They're literally keeping alive and feeding the sperm in the body. They can keep sperm alive for up to a week on the, you know, the longer end of things. It's not common that they do, but it is possible. And then that is really the only time, that week prior to ovulation, an average of 3 to 6 days prior to ovulation, where there are fertile fluids present. If you come into contact with sperm, it can result in a conception, which is also different than a pregnancy.
Right.
About 70% of conceptions do not end in a pregnancy naturally, and they will pass with the menses. Mm-hmm. And there's about 11 days on average between conception and implantation, which is what I would call a pregnancy.
Yeah. And I want to get a bit more into this, but first, because you've given that 3 to 6 day, possibly a week window. So if you're trying to avoid a baby, the other days are all fine, right?
Correct. Yeah. Healthy vaginal microbiome is acidic. It's very similar to a glass of red wine, and it will actually kill sperm on contact.
Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, going on with what you were saying before about that roughly 11-day period before it starts to implant. So if, I was going to say if sex occurs, but if sperm enters the vagina in that fertility window, and a baby is not desired at that time, is there anything that, you know, can be done to still prevent a pregnancy?
Yeah, there are many things that can be done. You want me to elaborate upon that?
Yes, please.
Sure. So if you understand your cycle and you have not yet ovulated, there's the medication called Plan B, is the brand name of it, which will prevent ovulation from happening, therefore preventing conception. And then from that point forward, we are dealing with a conception that we would like to inhibit the implantation of, knowing that 70% chance it's not going to even implant. So we're not really doing anything that is very far outside of, you know, the natural motions of nature. And so from clinical perspectives. There's other medication, the brand name in the States. Again, I'm not sure with New Zealand and pharmaceuticals, like if it's the same or if it's different. But there's a medication called Ella that is appropriate for inhibiting implantation after ovulation has already occurred or conception. I will also say that Plan B is not effective for people who weigh over 165 pounds. So that is not an option for people over 165 pounds. IUDs can be inserted to inhibit implantation. And also there are many plant medicines that can alter the body's hormonal balance and irritate the endometrial tissue, the mucosa, to inhibit an implantation. Obviously, plant medicine has a lot more nuance than pharmaceutical options, such as the medications or the insertion of an IUD. And that is something that is included in my Conscious Contraception Skillshare. And it's also the subject of a book that I wrote called Please Bleed, Plants and Practical Magic.
Nice. Well, yes, I'd love to, I don't know, I don't want to go too deep into it because you've, well, like you said, you've written a book and you've got it in your course online. But I would like it if you could just name a couple of herbs, because I'd love to know some more, not so much pharmaceutical options, but more natural sort of options.
Yeah, well, I think it's naming herbs. I'm happy to name some herbs under the category of amenagogues, is the whole category of herbs that can stimulate uterine bleeding and uterine contractions. Knowing that plant medicine is an extremely nuanced practice, and individuals' constitutions, whether they run hot and dry or cool and damp, and whether or not the plants grow in their bioregion or are appropriate for their lineage. I just want to name that whatever plants I mention may or may not be appropriate for individuals based on many, many different factors. Wild carrot seed is one of the most common implantation inhibition plants historically and globally speaking. Sometimes it's called Queen Anne's lace. My favorite combination of plants for my body when I have had some oopsies is Angelica, blue and black cohosh with large amounts of ginger.
All right. Yeah, that's good. So, yeah, thank you for those. And I guess, like you said, it varies very much from individual to individual, the dosage and that, how much it works. I guess, what would be the frequency of using these? Like, is it something you're really going to be wanting to do every month?
Absolutely not. Do not recommend using plant medicine as a regular means of contraception, but I feel like it's a really beautiful option that actually really isn't paralleled in pharmaceutical clinical products in terms of this implantation inhibition or even early abortion practices. There literally is nothing that works the same way that could potentially maintain the integrity of the menstrual cycle rather than interrupt a pregnancy. I call it the sacred yes. You can say yes to bleeding rather than no to a pregnancy, which is something, you know, having a menstrual cycle is a perfectly healthy, normal process to go through, and the plants can be allies to make sure that you menstruate rather than gestate, and the focus can be very different.
Yeah. Now, I interviewed someone recently who told me about the use of neem oil for men as a contraceptive. Do you know anything about this?
Sure. I mean, it's a spermicide. And then I believe that there's some evidence to show that. So it can be a spermicide, you know, applied vaginally or taken orally by the man who makes sperm. I don't really know what we have in terms of data, in terms of how that affects the whole ecology of the man's body, because it is essentially, it's a pesticide. I In general, why I don't recommend any sort of chemical contraception, whether it be herbal or pharmaceutical, is that it's going to alter our endocrine function and alter the microbiome of our bodies, which probably was less of a problem for our ancestors, one, because they didn't live as long, and two, because they were not dealing with as many endocrine disruptors in their environment, in their day-to-day lives. But my perspective is that we should not be knowingly interfering with our endocrine system with any of our day-to-day practices, and that it is healthful and ideal to encourage our endocrine systems to work as well as possible rather than knowingly inhibit them, which all methods of chemical contraception inhibit endocrine function, including plants.
Yeah.
So that's why I recommend them only in the case of an oops rather than a regular method.
Yes, right. Because my next question was going to be, what sort of natural contraceptives do you recommend for men or women? But I guess that would be charting your fertility and being aware of your body as a woman, rather than relying on taking something regularly.
Yeah, or a vasectomy. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
It's very, very simple process that from the men that I know and love in my life, they report that their sex drives and their sexual pleasure are not affected. And it's, you know, you go in and you have a procedure and you're outpatient and you're sore for a handful of weeks and that's it. Obviously, that's only appropriate for people that have the children they already want or know that they don't want any more or any children. But it is quite simple compared to all of the other processes that people with vaginas go through. And I really strongly believe that people with sperm who are fertile every single day really should be stepping up to be responsible for the fact that they are fertile every day, whereas we are only fertile for maybe 3 or 6 days out of the month and have been shouldering the burden of this process for way too long.
It's a very good point, yes. Now, what tips do you have for postpartum recovery for anyone, whether there was a live birth, a stillbirth, a miscarriage, or an abortion?
Yeah, so I love to bring menstruation into this also, even though, you know, your question is explicitly about the postpartum period. I use this term called the womb continuum to help describe the interconnection between all of the processes and experiences we have having a womb. And I really like to draw the connection physiologically, psycho-spiritually, between all of the bleeding times, whether we're bleeding from a normal menstruation or bleeding from a pregnancy release, which is a term that I use to encompass a live birth or a miscarriage or an abortion or even a stillbirth, that for whatever reason you're bleeding, there are some pillars of care that we all deserve during the bleeding times, including postpartum, which are rest, primarily, rest, nourishment, and warmth. And it's very, very simple. And I really want to emphasize that this is not about self-care, that it's great if you're able to take care of yourself, but that it's actually the responsibility of all the other adults who are not bleeding in your community or in your household to care for a woman when she's bleeding and provide, make sure that she has the opportunity to rest and make sure that she has very, very substantial nourishment to replenish the minerals that she's losing through bleeding and to make sure that her body stays warm, which is just a cross-cultural historical practice for any bleeding womb is keeping the body warm because the warmth brings circulation, which brings healing and soothes contractions, are much more coordinated when we're warm enough.
Yes. And yeah, that's one of the, that loss of community that we've had in the past few generations that, so, you know, so we're no longer surrounded by that. That's one of the disappointing sort of facets, I guess, of modern life.
Grief about that. Yeah.
So now when preparing for this interview, I saw that you previously worked as a sex ed teacher, and I wondered if you could offer any advice for talking to teens or preteens about safe sex, but approaching it from the angle of sex as a pleasurable interaction, not something immoral or shameful like our culture has done for so long.
Yeah. I still am a sex educator. I've been a sex educator for about 20 years. I started volunteering as a teenager at the local Planned Parenthood where I grew up. And, you know, the most important thing is to actually walk your talk as an adult. There's nothing that you could ever say to a child or a young adult that is going to convince them of a certain ideology if you are not actually embodying that reality. They're going to feel the difference between what you say and how you actually feel or what you're actually displaying in your own life. So I would say that, you know, really, really digging deep to address your own biases and where you are still carrying shame or subscribing to stigma around sexuality is step one. That there's no, you cannot give something to someone else that you do not fully possess. So that's really step one, is like, do you as an adult, as a care provider, as an educator, are you fully resourced? Have you really looked at your own processes and your own feelings and the way that you inhabit your own sexuality as a foundation before you're trying to offer something to someone else that you don't have? Beyond that, I would circle back to what I was saying earlier, where we need to decenter a penis and a vagina until it ejaculates as the definition of sex. And really, like, one of the exercises that I love to do with my conscious contraception clients and students, and I've done it with teenagers that I'm teaching as well, is like, literally make a list of all of the things that would feel good. It doesn't have to be sexual pleasure, but it should include sexual pleasure. Of like, what are all of the ways that feel wonderful to connect with somebody that you love? That you might be sexually intimate or attracted with as well, that have zero risk of an STI or a pregnancy. And really encouraging folks to be creative and to delight and explore in the reality that there are many, many different sensations and experiences that are safe, that do not risk a pregnancy or an STI. So that when you do engage in those risky behaviors, you're doing so with a real understanding of the risks and the benefits of those actions. And consent education, I'll take a pause. I could really just keep going for a long time. I guess I will just go ahead and share the etymology of consent as a very important teaching. Con being with, and sentir being feeling, in the Latin root, and really understanding that consent is not permission. Consent is feeling together. It's resonance. And that we don't sign away consent on a piece of paper. We don't consent to a sexual activity, and then you're just giving someone permission to do something to you. You consent is an ongoing process of embodiment and being able to feel, is this a yes for me, moment to moment, and that it can be revoked at any moment as well.
Very good. I'm glad I forgot to put in a question about consent, so I'm glad you put that in.
Sure.
Now, do you have any experience with talking to younger children, like between the ages of, say, 5 and 10, who are just curious about how babies are made?
Yeah, I have a workshop that I do that's not so much with the 5-year-olds, but at ages like 7 through 10, where we make the wheel of the menstrual cycle out of natural materials. I did this last summer, actually, around this time. So looking at the moon cycle and looking at the wheel of the year as templates, as analogies for the menstrual cycle. And we build it physically out of natural materials or wildflowers, is what I did last year. And then we'll move through the phases so they understand the parallels between the moon cycle and the wheel of the year and the menstrual cycle, and that the springtime with the wetness that comes is the fertile phase of the year, just like our fertile window is the fertile phase of the menstrual cycle.
Nice. That is a really, really cool way to look at it.
Yeah, it's
and easy for the kids to understand.
Yeah, our bodies really are the earth, you know, it's not a metaphor.
Now, we've actually gone through all my questions very quickly today. Is there anything like obvious that I've missed from what we've talked about already today that you think would still be important to share?
Obvious that you have missed. I feel like we covered a lot of really beautiful ground. I mean, really ultimately coming back into what it is to be embodied and to heal what the cultural norm is, which is, you know, we're collectively traumatized when it comes to sexuality and reproduction. And the vast majority of people that I have worked with as students or clients who've lived in this overculture are to either a small or large degree dissociated from their wombs and from their vaginas and their vulvas, right? Mm. So that would be one of the most important things to offer a child and to work on as an adult is something that's called interoception, where you're able to actually feel what is happening inside of your body. And in that way, you cultivate internal authority and the ability to actually give consent. Because if you can't actually feel in your body, you can't really give consent. You can't know what feels good. And really, really highlighting this reality that the fluids as our primary fertility signal, which to me is just so simple. It's so straightforward, and it's bizarre and horrifying and sad how deeply fearful and how deeply dissociated we are from our power, which is our ability to literally feel what is truly happening inside of our bodies, and then to advocate for our needs, that it really is that simple to avoid pregnancy or to achieve a pregnancy, that it really depends on your ability to sensually experience and feel what is true about your body, and then communicate that to a partner or a lover and have that lover or partner be 100% on board with whatever your preferences are, and then we're ending rape culture there, right? but yeah, that it really is about healing the trauma of dissociation, healing the power of the trauma of externalizing authority, of thinking that we absolutely must consume something from the medical industrial complex to manage our fertility or to embody our will, and that it really just comes back to depth of embodiment and honoring true consent.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I like the way you came kind of full circle there, right, all the way back to consent. Now, I was just thinking about how we were talking about in modern life, we have so many endocrine disruptors in our environment. And I wondered if you could give a few examples for the listeners who weren't aware of this.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, after World War II, there was a whole bunch of war chemicals that were going to be used for chemical warfare that they decided to repurpose as pesticides to spray all over our food. Brilliant idea. Same with the iron shavings, actually, that are in most breads and cereals these days. These are industrial byproducts that they didn't know what to do with, so they put them on our food. So that is a huge source of endocrine disruption, are pesticides that are put on conventional food, and even organic food is not safe from it because it's deeply infected the whole planet's water supply at this point. And it moves with the wind, and seeds will flow. So anyways, pesticides, conventionally raised meat that has antibiotics, plastics, everything plastic, certainly any food that you would eat wrapped in a plastic, or drinking water or a beverage out of a plastic bottle, those all very high in what are called xenoestrogens, which are estrogens that are made synthetically, which interrupt your endocrine function. They really disrupt and are extremely harmful to our body's ability to create its own healthy estrogen. What I say, meat, meat, dairy, vegetables, plastic, cleaning products, beauty products, and body products are a huge source. Anything that has a synthetic fragrance is generally a very harmful endocrine disruptor, and often they're neurotoxins as well.
It's a little bit terrifying to be like, well, that's pretty much everything that's around me.
Especially for women, right? Which make up, I don't know the statistics off the top of my head, but the number of beauty and body products with synthetic fragrance and endocrine disruptors that the average woman living under overculture Western society uses on a day-to-day basis is just absolutely horrifying. And then we imagine them additionally taking oral contraception to suppress their ovulation, or additionally having an injection or something else to disrupt the communication between the ovaries and the brain. And that is what synthetic hormonal contraception is a disruption between the conversation that the ovaries and the pituitary gland specifically ought to be having. And that there's many, many, many different issues that result from that disrupting endocrine system, the ecosystem of the body. And I call oral contraception ovulation prevention pills. Let's call them what they are. How about that? So people know what they're doing when they put it in their mouth. They're like, okay, I'm taking this pill to prevent my ovulation. It's not controlling birth. It's preventing ovulation. They're very different things.
I'm just wondering, because we've just talked about how much our lives are filled with so many terrifying objects and things that are messing with our hormones. Is there anything we can do to help our bodies to counteract that, to like help fight off those toxins that are entering our bodies constantly?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, right? Being mindful of what products you consume and allow into your body or your household being huge. And then again, supporting your digestion and proper elimination is absolutely vital. you know, things like saunas and regular exercise and sweating are very important. And again, back to the sleep, our body really heals and resets when it is sleeping. And proper nutrition. It's not just not eating the conventional foods. It's understanding what are actually the micronutrients, what are the building blocks of healthy hormonal activity, which again, I talk about that in my course in more detail.
Nice. Now, so I will put links in the show notes to your website and your Instagram pages. And what was the name of your course?
The Conscious Contraception Skillshare is the one that we've been speaking mostly about today. Yeah.
Great. And can people find that on your website?
They sure can.
Yeah. Great. And is there anywhere else that you recommend listeners go if they're interested in learning more about what we've talked about today?
Oh my goodness, there are so many places, but the best connect with me and my resources and receive my guidance is to join my online community, which is called the Fruit of Knowledge Learning Community. And I have monthly live events there and a very large archive of live workshops that have been recorded and replayed. And there's many, many different topics of workshops there. And then a massive resource library that I've been curating for many years, spanning all sorts of reproductive and sexual health topics. So that's a very low barrier to entry. It's $5 to join on tier one and have access to all of the archives and all of the resource library. So that would be the best place to find out more about my favorite resources and or, you know, ask me questions. You can submit to the members Q&A.
Nice. And I love the name of it, The Fruit of Knowledge. Very
cool. Thank you. Yeah, in Hebrew, so I'm born and raised Jewish, and I'm a big word nerd and etymology geek. And throughout the Old Testament, in the Hebrew text, this term knowledge is used interchangeably with sex. So knew her means that they made love. And this original story, right? The Garden of Eden, like it's the fruit of sex. It's sexual knowledge. And I like to, what if it was an original win instead of an original sin, that Eve was then empowered to be aware of her sexual power and her cycle. And there's a lot of different teachings around that. When we look at anthropology and the evolution of the story of the Garden of Eden, which is another passion of mine, poetics and anthropology, and really just digging deep into lineage and roots of all of these narratives that a lot of us are, you know, swimming in. We don't realize that we're just immersed in these stories. Where did they come from?
Yeah. Oh, I like that. I love the whole historical aspect of that as well. Now, Sam, thank you so much for having such an open conversation with me about topics that are typically shied away from. So I really appreciate you taking the time to share your knowledge with us today.
Certainly. It's an honor. And yeah, thank you so much for reaching out and being open to exploring these topics.
So now my final question for you to end on is, if the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
This is really inspired by Don Miguel Ruiz. He actually got back to this knowledge, this knowledge concept. He has a book that's called The Book of Knowledge. And essentially the theme of that is your felt experience is the truth. But there is absolutely nothing more true than your feelings. The minute that we start to use language or try and interpret our feelings, we're just artists telling a story, and that truly the truth, with a capital T, is a felt experience.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favourite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.